the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. In the aftermath of the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, more than 100,000 Japanese, the majority of them U.S. citizens, were imprisoned in internment camps. They were labeled enemy aliens and denied service in the American Armed Forces. That changed 1 year later, when an all-Japanese-American unit was created. It became the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and would become one of the most highly decorated units in U.S. military history. It produced 21 Medal of Honor recipients, including one to George Joe Sakato, our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles. His story begins in a small California town in the 1930s.
Terrence had a barbershop in the pool home. And then our grammar school years that we were there, and then we used to go, they wanted to move to Redlands, and we had to open up a grocery store and a meat market, fruit stand and a meat market. So we moved to Redlands, California, where I attended Redlands High School and graduated. And we had a good operation in the store, because we were competing with the Piggly Wiggly chain down the street. And that was our main competition that we had, but we had no problem with that. Mm-hmm. And we were doing real well. And we opened the doors on December the 7th, and lo and behold, Roosevelt's on the radio, and this Pearl Harbor was being bombed. I couldn't believe that. Therefore, we had to travel. We couldn't travel more than 3 miles, walk 3 miles away, and we were restricted to movements. And we were told that we would have to go to an internment camp, they called it, relocation camps. Barbed wire fence with the guard towers on each corner, machine guns pointed in, not out. And this was a... So before the actual time for us to move, they gave us 3 days to move out. And so we sold what we could get for the store and we bargained. And a fruit peddler had picked us up and took us to Phoenix, Arizona. And it was in the south side of the tracks. And so we had to move again because people in the south of the tracks of Phoenix had to go to Poston. So somebody invited us to stay in his back porch in north side of the tracks, so we was able to stay in Arizona for him. That's where I would work on a farm and picking cantaloupes at 110 degrees. I lost 35 pounds. And the meantime, the 100th Battalion was being formed with National Guards of Hawaii, and they didn't know what to do with them, and so they gathered them all up, sent them to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, took the basic training, and went overseas to Sicily, and General Mark Clark in Africa, and then Sicily, and then to Mount Salerno, and they tried to take a Mount Casino, which is a church atop of a hill, and they were ordered to take that hill. And every time they tried to go up the hill, was Jimmy to shoot them. So they became known as the Purple Heart Battalion. And General Mark Clark says, we need more men like that. And he had. So before, I tried to get in the Air Force, and my draft card says 4C, enemy alien. Enemy alien? I'm not an enemy. I was born and raised. I'm American. He says, no, you can't. Go down. to the 100th Battalion was became known as the Purple Heart Battalion. Then President Roosevelt says, well, we signed a decree that we would be able to join the Army. So thus, all the fellows from the pineapple fields in Hawaii gathered up. All those, those were in camps, volunteered, and we became a regimental combat team, 442nd Regimental Combat Team, Camp Shelby, Mississippi. And from Mississippi, they went overseas, and I said, now's the time for me to go in the Air Force again. So I signed up for the Air Force, and I got on a train. I was inducted at Fort Douglas, Utah, and on a train I got to Camp Blanding, Florida, and I'm looking out, and I said, where's the airplanes? What airplanes? You're in the infantry. Thanks a lot. The 100th Battalion needs replacements. So we became replacements. My brother was a first draftee. He was in Fort Ord, California, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And then they had sent him inland. And when I took basic training, I had to take basic training with all first draftees. They all had corporals, stripes, sergeants, and 50 of his raw recruits were with them. We did all the KP. The cadreman says, as long as you had taken basic training over, those stripes don't mean a thing. So I told him, how is it that they can't pull KP? They pulled KP, and my name was Mud.
Let me ask you about the 100th Battalion that was first established with all Hawaii. One of the great ironies of this whole situation, to me at any rate, is that for the protection of the mainland, these steps were considered to be necessary. But the place where the attack took place, which was much closer to the Japanese capability,
right,
there was never any such action taken.
No, there wasn't.
Why?
There were so many of them there, they didn't know where they could put them into a camp in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So they would have to ship them to the mainland to do that. So they left them there to help do the detail work around the Honolulu's and different islands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, but the National Guards were sent to Camp McCoy to do their basic training over again.
Another irony is that the relations between the Hawaiian Japanese who joined up and the American Japanese who joined up were very difficult at times, to say the least. Right?
They would talk pidgin English, and we couldn't understand what they were talking about. We were using regular English language, and we were clashing against it. He said, what? And bang, the next thing you know, we were fighting each other. And it got down to the point where General ordered a big bus for the Hawaiians to get on and took them to the camp in Jerome, Arkansas. And they went through the camps. Danny Inouye was one of them. And he says, he goes and sees guard towers on the corner, barbed wire fence, and we were in these camps, and we volunteered for these camps. Then the situation turned all the way around. We became first one company, together, we all grouped together. They realized that we had volunteered for these camps, and if they were in the camps like that, they would know if they would volunteer. But this is how we would do it. We were going to be Americans. We were going to fight together. So we became one big unit, and we went overseas.
Well, it was the bonding that took place was extremely close and tight in the end, was it not?
Yes.
What was the reaction to the fact that it was an all-Japanese unit, but it was led by Caucasian officers?
Yes, we had one. We also had a Korean lieutenant, and he joined us, and then the Caucasian officer says, Koreans and Japanese don't get along. So he says, We're all one army. We're all one unit. We're going to stay. So he stayed with him. He became the lieutenant for the officer for the 100th Battalion. And he was a tremendous soldier. He was a soldier. He should have had this medal.
Well, that says a lot. What was the reaction of your family to your going off, given the fact that you'd been forced out of your home, forced out of your father, had been forced out of his business, and other people were going from camps where they themselves were interned? At least you escaped that part.
Yes.
But what was your family reaction?
My father said, well, my brother was already in the army. He's first draftee. And when I volunteered, he says, this is your country. It's up to you what you want to do. And I says, if you believe you should do this, but don't make shame to the family. Don't bring shame. Don't do anything that you're not supposed to be doing. And at least try to support the Japanese, that we are Japanese, and then we are to show that we are loyalty to the United States. We want to show our loyalty to the United States. And when I thought, well, when I grow up and my children grow up, I want them to be looked up to rather than to be looked down on. And so this is my thoughts. I'm an American. I want to be looked up to. I want to be able to walk into any place without any discrimination. And this is what I was fighting for.
We're talking this week with George Josecato, the recipient of the Medal of Honor for his actions in World War II in Europe as a member of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. The conversation continues after these messages.
Look for the Veterans Chronicles podcast online at radioamerica.org. We will be right back. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with George Josecato, who fought in World War II with the all-Japanese-American 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and who was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions.
I was one of those 90-day wonders that came in. After all 90 days, I was drafted, and I volunteered with the service, went through basic training, and went overseas, and joined the 100th, and 442 had all gone up to Rome and came back to Rome, and I was one of the first replacements for those that were killed in action. And so then we aborted ships and we went to Marseille, France. And we went to Marseille. We went, we trucked us up so far because Patton had already come up and scooted them out of the area. So when we were boarding getting on these landing crafts from Marseille, We went around and around the boats for an hour, and I couldn't understand why we were going around the boats till everybody got off onto these landing crafts. And then we headed for shore. One of the sailors gave me a paper bag, and he says, "You might need this after an hour now." I used that bag before I hit the shore. But then we got to France, and we were bused. We took the cattle cars, 48 cattle cars, we'd go up 5 miles, and then they back up 2 miles, wait, and we'd back 5 more miles, and says, "Well, we're not getting anywhere with that." So they unloaded us up and got on trucks. So they trucked us up into towards the French border and the Italian border, to the Vosges Mountains. And we got off of those trucks and they had to climb the hills of near Brueres, France. And these hills were part of the Alps of Switzerland. You try to climb up a hill at a 45-degree angle, pulling yourself up, tree roots and everything up. I couldn't have gotten up. Somebody had to carry my pack. Somebody took my shovel. All I had was my rifle. I couldn't get rid of the rifle. So I got up. I was the last one up the hill. Then we started our action. So, first day of battle for me was, we didn't know what incoming and outgoing meant. Here we hear wow. That was incoming. Then I finally learned out, because I picked up myself 10 feet away from where I was, and felt, I got a nick here, and I got a nick in my leg. But I'm black and blue. But I see my buddy on the ground, face down, and I turned him over. He got hit in the jugular vein, and the pulse of this pencil stream of blood was coming out. And I couldn't stop it without choking him. And tried to stop it, and then not enough. He lost so much blood that he died on the way down. So that was my first casualty that I had to see. And that kind of struck home for a while. And then we had to, 100, already the first platoon and second platoon were up ahead. And third platoon was in reserve when this all happened. Then we had to go forward and hit the landmines. Now we had to get on our stomach and probe for landmines. And you probe inch by inch, and sweat's rolling down. What if I hit the trigger? It's going to explode, and I'll be praying to be abandoned, probing. Somebody hits the mine up to the right of me. Oh, my God. Then we go ahead, and artillery shells start coming. More artillery shells. Then I tried to dig in a hole, and I could only get about 6 inches deep and hit rocks and tree roots, and dug in my helmet, and I was, geez, what am I doing? I volunteered for this, and I'm falling through my helmet as far as I could and stuck my foot out and see if I could hit. Never happened. We took that hill, but I Company was down below. They had to go through the town of Brewers. They were going through the 100 Battalion on the other ridge, and we finally got to the end of this ridge, and we watched the I Company going through the town. The German's tank was going out, and then I see, pretty soon I thought, "Oi, they're leaving." The person that in the barrel of the gun is facing us, and next thing I see a ring of smoke around it, and he's shooting at us. I'm running the other side of the hill, and I'm trying to dig in, and the artillery shells coming in. So I didn't recognize the guy that was digging with him. What company is it? F Company. Where's E Company? Well, they're on the other side. I was still trying to dig in. I don't care where they're at. I'm trying to dig a hole, and I couldn't dig a hole. I pray, my God, what am I doing here?
That was a question George Josicato would ask himself many times before his war ended. When we come back, his role in the rescue of the lost battalion. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Vietnam area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest pace.
That's the ammunition
and the cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. The all-Japanese-American 442nd Regimental Combat Team saw plenty of combat action in Italy, France, and Germany during World War II. Perhaps its most notable effort took place in 1944, in a fierce five-day battle in the mountains of France, where the unit fought to rescue 275 American soldiers trapped by German forces. The rescue was achieved, but at enormous cost. Casualties in the 442nd were between two and three times the number of those actually rescued. Our guest this week is George Joe Saccato. He fought in that battle and was seriously wounded. 55 years later, he was awarded the nation's highest award for valor, the Medal of Honor, for his actions during that fight. He describes the scene and what happened.
This one hill overlooks the whole valley and also the railroad train runs in between. So we were on the opposite side of the field in the trees with G Company, and we're looking at this hill. And every time we tried to cross this open field in the railroad tracks, well, they would lob bombs, mortar shells down, and machine guns were firing. There's a knoll of rocky ledges like this, and the trees came down, the hill came down here. So we had the open valley here and the railroad tracks. And a little meadow over here, and the trees over there where we were. We could never get across that hill. At this point, any movement, troop movements, they could see for miles. And then the lost battalion was over there. And so every time we tried to put troop over there, they would call for artillery. So we had to take this hill. So we got in trucks, went around, and we got from the backside, we were now in enemy territory. So that night, you looked at your hands straight ahead, you couldn't see your hands. Till you looked up about 35, 40 degrees, and you saw the sky, then you see the main trunk coming down, and to avoid hitting that tree, we had to look up and look where the main trunk is so we can avoid hitting it. And we watched all night, then at dawn, we come in and we surprised the Germans. Germans didn't know we were back there. So at that we told Don, we come in our unit. I got three machine guns here. The other units went up here to cut the mortar shells, and the others went down below. So then we finally took that hill, but then the artillery shells started coming in. And when the artillery shells come in, oh my God. Then the artillery shells stopped. Counterattack. The Germans going to come up the hill again. When I took basic training, I couldn't shoot a rifle at a target 200 yards out there. They always gave me the signal that I missed the target. Maggie's door, they called it. What do you mean I didn't hit the target? The windage and all that kind of stuff, I couldn't. A fella had his Thompson submachine, another squad. So I saw this tank, and he crawled into the tank, and I saw the submachine gun. I threw my rifle away and picked up a Thompson submachine gun, took all the ammunition I could carry, and I used that. But then when I used it, facing up, it would go up. And I said, that's not illegal either. So I put it on the sideways, and then I see a target ahead. I aim to the left of it, then bound to hit something. So that's what I used. And so everything, when the counterattack started, anything that was moving, I would shoot at it. The wind would blow this twig over here, and I'd shoot at it. I thought, well, the German's behind the bush, because the bush is up about 2 feet high, a little over 2 feet. And you sit down, and you can see them. So when they stand up, you get them. So I thought, well, he's crawling up this way. So I, the move, tree's moving, so I shot it. Next thing you know, I ran out of ammunition. And I tried to get my other clips out, and it was wet. Snow rained on, and his webbing was wet, and I could, and this one German is coming up at me. I had a machine gun, pistol that I had taken from another machine gun that's in Belmont, the area before. So I had to pull that P-38 out and fired 3 rounds at him, finally stopped. So I crawled back down in the hole, nobody charging anymore, so I'm on the left flank now. I'm loading my guns up, pistols up, clips up, and then I happen to look up, and German outskirted me, and they were going up the hill. They're taking the hill back. Oh, my God. I told him, watch out for them. And my friend stood up and says, where? And he got shot. And I crawled over this hole, and I picked him up. And I, why? And he tried to say something, but it gurgled, and then he went limp on me, and I knew he died in my arms. And
well, this I've read somewhere, is you've said that this is sort of where you went crazy. Yeah. But what'd you do?
I was so mad and everything, I dropped my packs and all. I had the Thompson stuff filled up, so I got out of the hole and zigzagged up that hill. Before, I could never climb those hills. That day, I got extra adrenaline, and then I was able to run up that zigzag up that hill and shot so many prisoners, and I captured so many of them because they were waving flags, handkerchiefs, and then I said, well, go back that way, and we finally took the hill back. This is part of the Lost Battalion frontage of part. So then from there we had to go to rescue the Lost Battalion. The General Dahlquist said to rescue his unit, the 142nd couldn't rescue them. The other units couldn't rescue them. So up to the 440 tactic to rescue the Lost Battalion, no matter what the cost. So then we were on the left flank hill, and then I Company and K Company in the valley, and 100th was on the right. And we started to move our troops for the Lost Battalion. And the second day, I heard a mortar shell go off, and I hit the ground, and it was on the 100th Battalion Hill. Went off again, and I hit the ground again. Lost 100th Battalion. And the third one went off, and I says, well, that's the final round on that hill. Boom. I picked myself up 10 feet away, and I looked, and I couldn't. Then artillery stuff really start coming in. And I couldn't use my right left hand. I could pick it from the elbow, but I couldn't, from my shoulder, I couldn't pitch it. So I looked in the pack, and I had put an overcoat in there and packed it real tight. And it went through that. And I looked, and I took my jacket off. I see a hole in that. And I said, I feel all right. Then I felt the trickle of blood going down the spine. I must be hit. But I couldn't use my left arm. And the sergeant looked at it and said, nah, you're not hit. And he looked at it, oh, I guess so. So I had to go through the aid station. He says, go that way. Artillery was coming in and again. I hit the ground again. It blew me up again. And then I finally made it to the aid station.
Well, you lost more men from the 442nd than you rescued.
Right. So I didn't get there, but then I Company did the main thing. They only had 12 men left in a platoon of 40 feet. K Company had 17 men left. All of the officers were killed. And some of the others, 100 lost so many. So overall, we've lost 800 men, rescuing 280 men.
On another aspect of this, you were involved in marching into some French towns to be greeted by them.
Yes.
But what was the reaction of the French citizen when they saw who was coming to their rescue?
Yes, High Company went into the town, and people couldn't understand. Ooh, the Japanese are coming. They're the allies to the Germans. And they were kind of scared. They didn't know whether until we told them we're Americans. And then they finally started crawling out of and found out that we were Americans. And great! And everything after that was...
Have you been back?
I went back in 1994, and I went to see this on Hill, but it was private property, so we didn't want to come. But I was looking at it from the Frenchman took me up there to look at it, and I was looking at it, and here was a car driving up, and the Frenchman looked at me and he says, "Hey, Joe, Germans, and he's pointing like this, there were Germans in that car, and he's a Frenchman. He was kind of scared too. He didn't know what situation. So I went over and talked to the gym. I found out he had bought that a summer home. And then I said, well, the war's over and everything is fine and we should get along together. And so he invited us down to his house and he served us a few beers and we chatted and got along real great.
What was your reaction when you found that you and a number of your comrades were going to be awarded the Medal of Honor?
I didn't know I received the Distinguished Service Cross. When I got on the plane, when I wounded, the plane it was changing weather, so they bumped me off, but my records went with that plane. I got home, and first of all, I was in the seventh month and I was in Vancouver, Washington. My hometown paper had found out that I received the Distinguished Service Cross. And we had written up in the newspaper clipping. And my younger brother's, one of his classmates, sent him the clipping from the Redlands newspaper saying that I received the Distinguished Service Cross. And he sent me that clipping and I looked at it. How did hometown know about it? And I don't know anything about it. So I talked to Chaplin at Vancouver, Washington, and he said he looked into it. Then they transferred me to Mitchell Convalescent Hospital in San Diego. The day before I got discharged, Distinguished Service Cross came. So I told him, well, I got three boys from Hawaii, and they're going to be discharged with me, and they're going to go home, my house, and they're going to fly home. We'd have to change this flight schedule for them to go home. I said, so I don't have time for it. So he just pinned the medal on my shirt. And I went home. So I got home and I took a vacation and met my wife. And I got married, got the job, working for Marine Diesel. I couldn't get a job because... My wife had a sister was going to have a baby, so we had to go to Denver. I said, well, Denver has a trucking company, railroads. Couldn't get a job. They look at me and, oh, he's a Jap. They said, what about? Got 10 years of experience? I said, I just got out of the Army. I'm going to have 10 years of experience. But I was converting marine diesels in the water pump service in Arizona. That's when we did that, so... I said, no, I was working part-time while I was going to school at the post office. So after busting a few knuckles and converting fish plating trucks, extending their truck beds longer, I said, I'm going back to the post office. So I for 32 years in the post office, retired, and I get this phone call from Pentagon. This is General Kurt Leiter, and I want you to come to the White House. We're going to upgrade your Medal of Honor. I would distinguished service because of the Medal of Honor. And I did. I was sitting there, I couldn't speak. I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, what? Then he says, well, yes, we want you to come to the White House, but we're going to only get 10 of the family there. Because there's 20 of us getting it. 10 of their people is going to be in the Rose Garden. Wouldn't fit in the Rose Garden. So I told Kurt Leitner, I says, ah, that's all right, send me my medal. No, that's all right. So he finally arranged for we got there. It so happened that a Saudi prince had come into town, and they had put up this big plastic circus tent, chandeliers and trees and air-conditioned and everything. All the senators and different offices filled that. We had 500 people in that tent. President Clinton gave me this medal, year of 2000. I still couldn't believe it.
Our guest this week has been George Joe Saccato, a member of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team and a recipient of the Medal of Honor. Thanks to him for his service and for sharing his story with us this week. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.